Thanks, Dave Bennett. Justin Kaufman here. It's a download, 720 WGN with you till 11 o'clock tonight. The Northwestern Wildcats hold on against Chicago State. Not a strong showing for the Wildcats. I just talked to Coach Collins about that. I have to say, I think he nailed it, right? You got to grind him out. This is December college basketball. Not everyone's going to be pretty. And they won when they needed to. This makes I believe the Wildcats are now 8-2. I think we talked about this a couple nights ago, that makes them like 8th or 9th in the Big Ten. So you're having a problem with putting away Chicago State, who I looked up. I did a little research for you people, because that's what I do here. I Googled Chicago State basketball after I got through several different articles about losing state funding from the university. I got to the basketball team, and I thought, oh, this is probably one of those upstart teams that, is 8-0, but they don't play anybody. Nah, they're 3-6, 3-7. They were not a good team. They got blown out by Wisconsin. That's the only team they really played worth anything earlier in the season. So not a great showing, but a win. And a win is a win. Like I said, Dayton coming up, and then after Christmas, the Big Ten schedule starts, and that's where it gets interesting. They got to tighten this stuff up now because they're going to have to win. They're going to have to go 500 at least in the Big Ten to possibly get a berth in the tournament. Because if you think about it, they're probably, because there's so many strong teams, even this year more than ever in the Big Ten, that it's really, really difficult to win that tournament, the Big Ten tournament, which is the automatic mm-hmm. bid to get in. So then you're looking at an at-large, and obviously the Big Ten does a lot of at-large bids to get in, or there wouldn't be a tournament because there's always like 10 teams. But they got to squeak in on that. So a big win tonight, which only big because it could have been a loss. It was that close. I mean, it was down like 4 minutes of play. We're talking about a tie game.
Win, yeah, win's a win. Get it on and put it in the win column.
Yeah.
Move forward. Wouldn't it be great if, like, Chicago State and DePaul and Loyola right. and UIC, wouldn't it be if they were all great? I mean, Chicago has...
Oh, like at one time. Like it was 1 year. Just, like in 2018, and each team was like just doing it.
You see all these mid-America, or mid-whatever they call them, mid-level mid-major, or mid-majors. Yeah. Yeah. Doing well in a tournament. Which would be great to see.
Yeah. I grew up on the DePaul Blue Demons. I mean, it would be great. That's what we had Coach Joey Meyer on, who we just heard in the broadcast. We had him on at the big table last year talking about those days. But, it's funny that it's the Dayton Flyers that they play on Friday Northwestern, because it was the Dayton Flyers was, I believe, and I could be wrong. I'm sure there's some purists out there, college basketball purists. But I believe that was the last time the DePaul Blue Demons were in the tournament. They got beat by Dayton the Stone Age. Whenever it was, when they were, they had the first Dave Leto round. I think it was Dayton. Either they knocked off Dayton I think they knocked off Dayton in the first round. They got beat big by somebody, Miami or Ohio State, in the second. But point being that's funny that Dayton is brought up again, because that's the mid-major that usually, you're right, is a 10 seed coming into the tournament. That's what you'd like to see, a DePaul or a Loyola.
Yeah.
I'd like to see a Loyola. I'd also like to see UIC.
Right.
And there's enough talent.
Seems to be.
Yeah.
You see all, obviously, Jabari Parker is probably not going to go to UIC, but why not DePaul?
Yeah. And, they win. If UIC or Loyola or DePaul win, DePaul is the Big East, so that's very difficult. Now, have they switched that up yet? Is that still the Big East? Did they go to the Catholic League yet?
Is it this year? They're in a, I'm not sure what league.
Because they were
in
the Big East, and then they made this big sort of announcement, I think it was last year or the year before, that they're going to a more sort of Catholic league.
I think the Big East is actually now
it's
league.
Is it that league? So, but either of those, whatever, the Horizon League, all three of those teams, if they win their division, if they win their conference, they get an automatic bid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, I think Chicago State might be a different story in the sense that they might have to win and then get lucky, or I don't know if they have an automatic bid out of their conference. But that's what I'm saying. Like, they could get on a run. Loyola could get on a run, win their tournament, and get a 14 seed and get in. Let's see that.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, let's focus on Northwestern first. Yeah.
I think this is their year. I think they got to get some things together, almost losing to Chicago State. But Dave and Joey, great call. It's a download here on 720 WGN. We got a great show lined up tonight. Can you believe it? They have to change the sign at City Hall. An indictment handed down to Alderman Willie Cochran of the 20th Ward, the first since 2010, I think, Ike Carruthers. 6 years they had it going. How about it? You know, Emanuel had a clean record. And now an alderman indicted on bribery charges, on money, I guess just mishandling of funds. We're going to talk to Mike Fouché. He's in tonight. He'll come up right after the 8:30 news. But there's one of the things they alleged that Alderman Willie Cochran in the 20th Ward did is that he was taking money out of an account that was for set up for children in the 20th Ward. 20th Ward's a tough ward. Inglewood's a part of that ward. That's not an award that if you're getting, I mean, I think he took $25,000 out from that fund and to gamble. This is what they allege. That's what they accuse him of. $5,000, they say, went to his daughter's college tuition. That's $30,000. You think about all of the talk that we have about, you know, making sure that resources go. We are on this program talking about, and then you have politicians who may or may not be standing in the way of that, taking that money. The one that grabbed me out of this, I don't even know how he did this. This is why this is like Donnie Brasco type stuff. It said that he withdrew $25,000 from the fund using ATMs near casinos where he gambled. $25,000, like, is, I mean, are we talking like over a period of years? It has to be, right? Or is he like doing a, he's got like 19 ATMs and he's taking out 400 each. I mean, I was just in Vegas and I think I took out 350 bucks or 400 bucks when I got there. And they're like, that's your limit. Like, you can't, you, that's all you can take out in one day. How many days does he have to do that to take out $25,000 from the fund through an ATM machine? It'd be one thing if he's going into a bank or he's got a, you know, somebody's like transferring electronically. But he's outside the horseshoe or something going, let me put my pin in.
Just being at a casino that often raises a red flag.
I mean, obviously.
Like not doing his work. Shouldn't he be doing a job?
And another thing, we'll talk to Mike Fouché about this, but the guy, it all comes out of, what's his name? The Faisal Khan, who was the legislative inspector. We talked about this story too, who the city council said he wasn't really needed and he wasn't doing a good job, so they took away his position and they dissolved it into Ferguson's job, the IG. And now you're like, I'd really like to know how Willie Cochran voted on that one, right? If he was an alderman that said, you know what, I don't think we need it either. I don't think so. And they all went, yeah, That's ridiculous. Like, you already you raise red flags, don't you? When you're like, I don't think we need the inspector. I don't think we need an inspection general, right? Why do we need a legislative inspector general? Yeah, no, we don't need it. We're clean. You raise red flags when you vote to do that. And it was his work that led the U.S. Attorney's Office to look at Willie Cochran. So there you go. So that's coming up. We'll talk with Mike Fouché. Also tonight, we're going to do a segment where we're talking about early history and development of Chicago suburbs. Historian and author Elaine Lewenick. The Working Man's Reward. It's a new book, and we're going to talk with her about how the Chicago suburbs were created. Really interesting stuff. And then we're also going to talk with Broadway star Ashley Brown. How great is that? She played Mary Poppins. She was Mary Poppins when they created the Mary Poppins Broadway musical in 2006, I think it was. She, at 24 years old, got the job. She's going to be at the Orchestra Hall on Friday for a Merry, Merry Chicago. She's singing standards with some of the symphony orchestra, so we'll talk with her as well. So that's coming up tonight. So good show, right?
I love that. I love that movie.
She and she, could you imagine being a 24-year-old and like they're going to turn that? Because I didn't realize that they had not made a Mary Poppins Broadway musical. Because you would think that it almost feels like it should have been a Broadway musical.
That'd be like a natural fit.
Yeah, right? And they finally did it in 2006, and they cast a woman who was, the only credit she had was she was in Beauty and the Beast on Broadway, which is a pretty big deal too, but she was a... the only credit was starring as Belle in Beauty and the Beast. I mean, anyone could do that, right?
Well, I mean, I dressed up like Belle once, but I don't really talk about it that much.
You don't put that on the resume, right?
No. No, fortunately, there were no pictures.
How are you, Rob?
Not bad. How are you?
Good, man. Good. Do you agree with that? A good win, but a sloppy win, but a good win. Huh?
It happens. That's what these guys go through. I mean, look, Chicago State, give them credit. They got on a run. They got hot. They hit, nine three-pointers in a row or something like that and closed the gap. But, Northwestern.
Chicago State played as if their college lives depended on it, because it does, because funding is tight.
It was a battle of the cats at Welsh Ryan.
That was it.
The Cougars and the Wildcats.
I feel like throughout the night I'm going to pepper in razzes at Chicago State for their funding issues.
Usually you only get a battle of
basketball.
It was good. It was a good win. It was a good win.
It's a win. We'll take it, right?
Absolutely.
I hope we're doing this exact segment in 2 months when we're like, hey, it was close, but they beat Purdue. Good win. Good win. Because that's when they're going to need to win against the Purdues and the Michigan States and the Nebraskas and the Wisconsins.
I'm with you, though. I mean, look, Chris Collins was a standout at Glenbrook North, was a standout at Duke, was under Coach K.
Coach there, yeah.
I mean, so he's got the pedigree. I think he's doing a great job.
All right. I like it. I think this could you just think back to those games. Who was it? Who'd they lose to? They lost to Butler early on. And mm-hmm. It was one where I was like, yeah, and they came so close. And then there was another one they lost to. Was it Notre Dame.
Yeah.
So those two. But those are both perennial teams in the tournament, and they're both having great seasons. So. This is our indictment blues.
Man, this is some
riff.
Sad stuff. This is like you're sitting in jail and you're bummed out. Jeez.
Mike Fouché is here from the DailyLine.net, joins us every Wednesday. Good to see you, buddy.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Big time news today. 20th Ward Alderman Willie Cochran.
Is that big time? I guess.
I guess it is in the sense that there hasn't been an indictment of an alderman in 6 years now. But 20th Ward, we kind of knew this was coming because there was rumors about the feds looking into his work. He kind of responded saying, hey, that happens all the time.
Yeah, and actually a source had told me that they had gotten together with him last week. And he was pretty much expecting the hammer to come down, and he had lawyered up.
He's got
Willie Cochran and lawyer
Thomas Durkin, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you this before we get into it. So 20th Ward Alderman,
brother of
the other Thomas Durkin or Jim Durkin?
Of Jim Durkin.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
There's so many Durkins. Are they all related?
I think so. They all get together and drink.
Okay, so let me ask you this. All right, so the 20th Ward Alderman, Willie Cochran, is indicted today on charges of bribery, I guess embezzlement would be the charge. What is the actual, what's
so
the indictment?
This is basically the scheme, all right? And so what he was doing is that there are these various redevelopment funds that you can get in impoverished parts of the city, which the 20th Ward is
20th
in.
Ward is Southside, Englewood.
It's in Woodlawn, Grand Crossing, a little bit of Englewood, little bit of Back of the Yards. But it's mostly Woodlawn and Washington Park. And so in order to get money for these redevelopment funds, you have to have an alderman sign off on it and say, you're a bona fide good project, and so you should get some money. Okay. And so he would give developers a letter of recommendation for these projects, and then he would say, all right, now I would also like you to write a check to my 20th Ward Activities Fund, which is what it was called. And it was a fund that was kept off the books in terms of campaign spending. He wasn't reporting it as campaign money because he would say it's not campaign spending. What it was supposed to be was for back-to-school picnics.
It's for the kids.
For the kids, right. You know, good stuff for the kids. And he was also doing it where he would write letters of support for people who wanted to get liquor licenses for bars and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So any time that an alderman needed to do that, he was doing it. And he would tell people, well, just give me a check for a dollar amount and leave the name blank sometimes. And so then he would fill in the name. Right, I know. It's cool, right?
When you read that kind of stuff, and I was just reading the report and the indictment of Alderman Cochran. I mean, it does play out of just it takes you right back to the 70s, sort of 70s Chicago.
So I didn't say this at the beginning, but I want to say it again. This is all alleged by the federal.
We said that at the time.
By the feds. And so this is alleged activity. And supposedly he was doing this. And supposedly it all went into this account, the 20th Ward Activities Fund. And then he was using the money for personal things. So he paid $5,000 to his daughter's college tuition. And then he withdrew $25,000 from his from ATMs near his favored casinos is the thing.
They sort of alleged that he had a gambling problem and he was gambling.
Using it for his gambling. And then he also used it for other buy knickknacks and other personal effects. So, you know, I don't know what they are. They didn't say what they were, but items for personal use in his home.
You could say it, Eddie Van Halen's guitar.
You know, I'm thinking he's got maybe like a sewing thumb thing, you know, or whatever those are.
Right.
You know,
all right. So let me. I had questions, and I was kind of talking about this before the news. Just, I mean, the idea of withdrawing $25,000. Are we talking about over a period of time? I mean, they kind of said 2011 is when the college tuition things. But it was over a number of years.
Over a number of years, and you know, you and I were debating about how much you can actually take out from an ATM.
I guess you can change the setting.
I've seen ATMs at casinos where you can take out $1,000.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I must not have unchecked the right box because I must still be at like the beginner's.
Yeah, the beginner
you're
box.
Under 25 kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, let me tell you something, man.
Yeah, there's ways to go around the
there
box.
Are
I got
ways,
it.
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, he's been doing this for a couple of years. And you know, they say that back in 2011, what took the Fed so long?
You know, they take a while to build their case. And what Faisal Khan, the former OIG, the former legislative inspector general, has been crowing that this was something that he had forwarded on to the feds when he was fired from his job and the job was eliminated. And that this is now one of the things that he had been working on that the feds finally developed into a case. And what Faisal Khan said about a year and a half ago when the job was eliminated and he was effectively fired was that he was doing too good a job of investigating the alderman, and this is one of the things that he found.
I mean, it's hard as, you know, the casual observer of Chicago politics, the idea that the city council voted to eliminate an investigator.
Right.
Because he was doing too good of a job, or what they said, you know, well, we don't really need him because everything's clean.
Right.
You know, it'll go to somebody else that we trust more. I mean, it stunk then, it stinks now.
Right. Well, you know, okay, I would just want to pause for a minute on Faisal Khan's claim. You know, he made this claim. The feds do not speak about this kind of stuff. They don't speak about anything.
Right.
Maybe they might talk about it after the case is all over and somebody goes to jail. But, you know, we don't really know how much of it is
that
you know, maybe he had an idea and he said, hey, I think something's going on. Now, for what it's worth, when I first heard about this, that the feds were poking around about a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago, I called the Department of Justice and I said, hey, you know, what do you guys got to say about this? And they are very firewalled over there. You know, the attorneys don't speak to the guy whose job it is to be the public information officer. They don't tell him anything. And they don't tell him anything until something happens. So then he has plausible deniability. And so, you know, when I call the guy up, he says, well, I don't know anything about it. I can't confirm or deny it. And, you know, so I'm like, and actually, I think I said, you know, I'm asking about Willie Cochran. He said, who? And so, you know, they are very meticulous about making sure that they can not confirm or deny anything. They say nothing. So, you know, they're not going to be able to tell you anything for
a while. Let me ask. All right, so this comes from a texter, we just did a quick search, and he's absolutely correct, saying that he lives in the 20th Ward.
Yeah.
And this is not the first time. Willie Cochran is indicted.
Yeah.
Andrea Troutman was indicted and convicted.
Yep. Famously yelling at reporters from the window of her house.
This was, 10 years ago, probably? 8 years ago
yep.
now? Before that, and with Cliff Kelly. Cliff Kelly represented the
20th cleaned
Ward.
Up and is now
a great radio host
at WBON.
But the point being that there is a legacy and history of corruption in the 20th Ward. Why do you, as
I
someone
have no
who covers
idea.
Politics, why would it be like that?
I have no idea, and it's certainly not geography, because the 20th Ward is sort of marched down south. It used to be much more of a west side ward, and it's gone further south, and those boundaries have moved quite a bit. So you can't say, well, it's the people that live in the 20th Ward, because it hasn't been the same people all these years. And what's interesting is that Arenda Troutman was vilified as being a machine politician who was taking advantage of all our daily connections. And Willie Cochran was supposed to be somebody who was going to really turn things around and be better. You know, and I have no idea. I don't understand.
So this is an alleged, it's an indictment, but it's alleged.
And Willie Cochran is a former police officer.
Yeah, it's correct.
He's a former police officer.
Willie Cochran today said he's going to stay as alderman, because he's saying all this is trumped up, this is not going to stick. But
well, of course.
He said he's going to stay in his office. He has no plans to resign.
Right. And that is legally the prudent thing to do, because if you resign your job and you leave, that's essentially saying I did something bad. And so you have to behave as if you did nothing bad, because you still got to pick a jury. I'm sure he's going to try and go to trial, and you have to keep appearances up. Now, in terms of his political career, he's sunk. He's over. He's done. You know, he's had two very close runoff campaigns in the last two elections. This last one, the guy Kevin Bailey, who is a young man, he's a civil engineer for Union Pacific Railroad, and he's really got a lot together. He came very close to beating him. And in fact, Willie Cochran, I don't know if there was a backroom deal between the two of them, did not run for ward committeeman again in 2016. And Kevin Bailey won it outright without having any opposition. So in a lot of ways, Cochran was beginning to hand things off to somebody. But there is no way he could win an election at this point.
It's surprising to me. The last thing I'll ask is about Mayor Emanuel. Reporters asked Emanuel what he said. He actually made a good point about, everyone's going to want to put this on Chicago as business as usual,
right,
city politics.
Right. And in the press conference after city council, he said, hey, look, guys, there are people being indicted in Alabama. There's things going on in New York City, in the New York City Council. You can't put this on Chicago. And he has a good point. It has been a while. We got to flip over the calendar now, the number of days since the last indictment. But, we're not so bad, right?
There you go. All right. We'll continue with Mike Fouché from the dailyline.net. He's in studio as he is every Wednesday. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Hey, we got a new clerk.
Clerk. Whoop.
Mike Fouché in studio.
That's more jail bummer music.
That's the theme. All right. Other things happening in city council this week. Flavored tobacco. This was something that there was there's the ban. It's
so,
been going on.
This is really funny. Flavored tobacco is basically you get like cigars that are flavored or cigarettes that are flavored, and they had been banned in Chicago.
Is this like menthol and company?
Menthol is one of them, but also you get like those vanilla cigars and all the cigarillos that are like dipped and stuff. Those are gnarly. I think they're disgusting and they smell horrible. That's my personal thing. But I guess a lot of people like them. But also the other big charge is that teens really like them.
So there was for a long time a ban on them in Chicago, or there was a wanted ban.
Yeah, there was a ban.
Near the schools, right?
Yes. Well, there's a ban. And so one of the arguments that was made by 11th Ward from Bridgeport, Alderman Patrick Daly Thompson, is, well, hey, look, in Chicago we now made it so that you can't be 21. You have to be 21 before you can buy tobacco anyway. So let's lift this ban on flavored stuff, because it's really about trying to keep kids away from cigarettes and cigars. It's no big deal. And actually, I interviewed him about it 2 months ago, and he said, it's basically just the stuff that the old guys like to have, those vanilla cigars, which, frankly, I've never seen that, but, man, that sounds disgusting.
Yeah.
And so what the new ban is that it's basically from property line to property line, from a store to a school, there has to be 500 feet before they can be able to sell.
Is there, I guess I asked just as a national trend, when I think about these kind of products that were the flavor of the month when it comes to politics, we're going to ban this, we're going to ban that. Tobacco really sort of hit it on, they really took it on the chin in the sense that they were like, everything tobacco has been banned by councils across the country.
Yeah.
Is this a mark that we might see less of a rollback, in other places where it's just like, all right, maybe we went too far. We've changed the rules. Tobacco can kind of come back.
I don't know. I'm not buying that, because city council just put it, or Cook County Board just put a tax on soda.
Yeah.
So, or flavored drink, or sweetened drinks, sugar sweetened drinks. So I don't know.
You don't know.
I mean, it's too hard to call a trend like that. It is kind of interesting that that their city council is now like, hey, it's okay, don't worry about it, enjoy your sin.
Now, is the next move to say, enjoy it, and we're going to put a $2.50 tax on
it? Well, there's actually already a tax on it. I mean, city council has raised taxes on cigarettes a lot anyway. Right. Buying a pack of cigarettes is, I don't know what it is. It's crazy. It's like 20,
I don't smoke, and
25
I,
bucks. Yeah. one of my reporters does. And another one of my reporters has family in Indiana. So every time she goes to visit family in Indiana, she brings back, you know,
is there that
cartons of cigarettes
difference?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you say $25 a pack?
I think so.
Is that what it is?
I think that's
because I remember it being like 15 to 18. And then, but anyway, I remember being a kid in Wonder Lake, Illinois, and it was $2.99.
No. It's super high. And,
wow.
And I think in Indiana, it's way lower. And Indiana actually.
Still high, but low.
Indiana has one of the higher smoking rates in the country.
Because it's cheap.
Because it's Indiana. I mean, I don't know. I'm in Illinois, so I'm going
to
dump on them.
All right. Let's go to the clerk. There's a new clerk to replace Susana Mendoza, who is now
the Illinois comptroller.
So who did we go? We talked about this last week. There was a couple of names.
So there were a whole bag full of names, all Latino, because the mayor had said that he wanted to appoint a Latino to replace a Latino, and in particular he was looking for a Latina. And one of the names that was in contention was the mayor's director of intergovernmental affairs, Ana Valencia, who's 31 years old and not from Chicago. She's actually originally from the Peru Valley, and, you know, kind of a surprise in certain ways, and others not so much, because she's extremely loyal to the
mayor.
What
do you need to be the clerk? I mean,
nothing.
Is there any sort of political experience you need?
No. And the clerk is, you know, it's exactly what it sounds like. You're clerking, and you're taking care of a lot of paperwork, you know, so there's marriage licenses, dog licenses, the city stickers, stuff like that is handled by the clerk. So it's not a lot of, you know, really deep stuff.
The city sticker is the most prominent thing. That's when it comes out in the summer or whenever you're
And a marriage license, too. You got to go there if you're going to get married.
And that has had ups and downs. I mean, there have been times when you're you know, and Susana Mendoza had really kind of, and Mayor Emanuel with the city sticker at least, have offered like maybe a 2-year deal. They changed it up and they've
messed lowered
around.
Prices. And,
but
you
see this as someone who is an inexperienced politician who is essentially
She's not inexperienced. That's not true.
Well, I mean, inexperienced in the sense she's never held an elected office.
That's true. She's not a Chicago politician. Okay. You know, her background was...
But she's loyal to Mayor Emanuel.
She's loyal to Emanuel. She had worked for Dick Durbin long ago and had actually run one of his reelection campaigns. And she actually worked for Donna Moore, who was supposedly Emanuel's candidate for state's attorney. So she's done a number of things like that.
She's worked in enough offices to understand.
She knows her way around the city hall, but she doesn't necessarily know. One of the complaints about her is that she doesn't really know the city. Like if you asked her to describe a really cool restaurant at 47th and Archer, she probably wouldn't be able to come up
with
that.
And I guess I would, the playing devil's advocate, is that necessary to be the clerk to handle the paperwork
of dog licenses and marriage licenses? Probably not. But you know, one of the things that's interesting is that the other elected positions in the city have sometimes not really been the mayor's people. So you look at Treasurer Kurt Summers.
Bingo.
Treasurer Kurt Summers is really, you know, he might actually be running for mayor. He's not really necessarily the mayor's guy. Ana Valencia definitely is the mayor's person. In fact, in the press conference today that the mayor had where he was announcing it officially, he said, now I'd like you to go find out if this office should be abolished and come back and give me a report in 6 to 9 months. Like he gave her marching orders right there in front of everybody, which if it was Susana Mendoza, who really wasn't the mayor's guy, the mayor's woman, she came from Ed Burke, really. You know, if he had turned to her and done that, you know, I don't think he would have been able to get away with it. So Ana Valencia is his person. And one of the reasons why he chose her, I think, is that now he's got a person that will go stump for him in 2019. Yeah.
To the victors go the spoils.
That's right.
Mayor Rahm Emanuel's new clerk, Ana Valencia. Mike Fouché, he runs a dailyline.net. You can read all about
And we've got a great podcast, too,
great podcast
on iTunes and Stitcher.
The Aldercast, which covers everything. It's released on Fridays, right?
It's released on Fridays, yep.
Check it out on iTunes, Stitcher, Aldercast, and you can check him out here on Wednesdays on The Download. Mike,
great to be here.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. I like this music. And there it goes. fading away. Elaine Lewenick's going to join us. She's an author and historian. She wrote a new book called The Working Man's Reward. It really takes a look at the earliest suburbs and sort of development of Chicago. She's coming up here. We'll catch up with her in about 10 minutes. I have to say, it's really interesting, and the book is great. But it's really about, and I always forget about this stuff because, you know, when you think suburbs, I think, well, Riverside, right? Riverside out west is one of the first sort of what she's talking about is really about, really dating back to 19th century Chicago, even before the Chicago Fire, and how a lot of what we see and when we see like in propaganda, when we think about like the posters, and it's even on the front of her book, this poster of like, you know, this great shining moment, like, come to the suburbs, come to the suburbs. They were talking about the stockyards. You know, like, we think suburbs, and I think, oh, it's probably, you know, when you see those posters, those old, like, sort of almost feel like iconic sort of 1950s. They're way earlier than that. And when they say come to the suburbs for prosperity and new opportunities, they're talking about Bridgeport. Right. And when you start to, you're like, oh, that's what they mean by that. They're not talking about Bolingbrook. And it's just so interesting about how even then to move into some areas now that are so urban. And it was really about like there was an area, the city that was that they were trying to bring people to on the south side that was around the stockyards. That was almost like this was the suburban opportunity, suburban, if you will, flight. And it's when you think about it, you're like, well, those places now are considered very urban. Like those are the places that even, you know, even I guess you'd say maybe even a century ago, early 20th century, people were escaping from, not necessarily escaping, but moving to other places. But it's an interesting, fascinating look at Chicago's sort of all the marketing and everything that goes into where the suburbs were. And it's really Andersonville plays a role in the book. Even as someone like, I mean, even go further like northwest, like Albany Park and those kind of areas, which you would think are part of the city as we know it now, but they were sold to Chicagoans at the time as suburbs. That's where you want to go, in the suburbs, the stockyards, Bridgeport, Canaryville, those kind of areas, even back of the yards. I think that's exactly what she's talking about, back of the yards. I mean, it's called that. But there was this push at that time for that to be the almost like the log cabin, you know, white picket fence experience. But it was like downriver from the stockyards and everything, all the byproduct that came from the stockyards. They were essentially selling a pretty terrible place to live as a suburban experience. So that's what we're going to talk to her about. I like that. A little history. Throw a little history at you. You know, it's not just current events. Throw some history at you. That's coming up next. Also tonight, Ashley Brown, the award-winning, I mean, great Broadway star. She was Mary Poppins. She played Belle in Beauty and the Beast. She's now she's performing with members of Chicago Symphony Orchestra at Orchestra Hall this weekend, actually for a week. Merry, Merry Chicago. Singing like, almost like old American songbook for Christmas. So it's not going to be your what we had with the Bangers where they're playing a bunch of Phil Spector stuff. It's going to be more like, I don't even know what American songbook stand. Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Man, that was good. The headphones on. That's, oh, man. Really got to wag. Man, maybe got to rethink my career. I gave up on singing way too quick. Chestnuts. I'll get it. I'll get it in this break. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we heard from author Jonathan Rose recently. He was talking about the early signs of urban life in human society and the origins of the American city. We touched a bit on the suburbs, but you know what? We really didn't go into it. But tonight we thought we would talk more about the history of suburban development here in Chicago and how it may have been the genesis of urban sprawl as our country knows it. My guest tonight is Elaine Lewenick. She's the author of The Working Man's Reward, Chicago's Early Suburbs and the Roots of American Sprawl. In the book, Elaine looks at the forces at play that created suburban sprawl, but also what it meant to be chasing the quote-unquote American dream. Elaine Lewinnick is a professor of American Studies at California State University, Fullerton, and she joins me tonight. Elaine, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'm fascinated by the marketing aspects of the American dream. We've heard about this American dream, this picket fence, this the idea that you own this suburban home, and that's really what we're at. But reading your book, I mean, it really comes in this roots of product, of business, of marketing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, first of all, it wasn't an American dream. It's an immigrant dream. At the turn of the century, in every city that we have studied, native-born Americans wanted to rent and not own. It was mostly European immigrants who brought this yearning for home ownership. And in Chicago, which held itself up as a model city, people were critical of it. They called it the peasant yearning for land. They thought it wasn't a good thing to sacrifice other things like your kids' schooling to pay for your home. But that idea that home ownership brings a certain kind of respectability and a certain kind of citizenship,
inclusivity,
not,
too.
Yes, but it's not an eternal American dream. Very early America, people rented, people boarded, even when they had a lot of space. They lived just on the southern tip of Manhattan. They lived just around the fort that was early Chicago. They did not sprawl out into single-family home ownership. And they didn't even live in what we think of as nuclear families. They had apprentices and boarders and grandmothers and aunts and house guests who never left. And the idea that you would live in a house with just the nuclear family and that it would be a house you want to own, that came fairly late in America. It comes after industrialization.
And that really was a marketing push, too, to sell mortgages and houses and the business of real estate.
Yeah. It was marketing the land, too. The early developers of Chicago had to market that you want to buy land here. And people didn't. It was swampy. It smelled of garlic, you know. They had to make up the idea that this is going to be a city. And it's a city that you want to invest in because someone else is going to want to buy it from you. And that whole invention of ideas of property values, it happened here. And it happened in amazing ways. If land that costs $1 an acre in 1830, you could sell for $80 in 1836. You could make so much profit. Although then it was only worth 50 cents in 1842. And so there were these real estate booms and busts that make things it's weird precursors to today, you know, and we've all seen in the last 10 years what happens when the real estate market fails and how that has ripple effects through so much else. The real estate market created Chicago, and that dream of homeownership for everybody was pushed in Chicago from the top down, but also from the bottom up, from those immigrants.
Let's talk about late 19th century. I mean, right before the Chicago fire, I mean, this was a town that was on the make. I mean, this was everybody. I mean, it was almost growing too much, as we know. But this was the sort of model of American cities. This was a place that people wanted to be. But there wasn't as much suburban sprawl at that point. Right now, before the fire, it was just really concentrated, dense city.
There was just the little bits, like Riverside had been built in 1869, I think it was. So, you know, a couple years before fire.
Right.
And which we think of now as this model planned suburb. But even it actually went bankrupt in the 1890s. It wasn't a model that people embraced. That suburb as a residential only space, as an elite space, as a space that's marked as white only, that was not Chicago's model at all. Chicago had a different kind of sprawl. Because Chicago was diverse, and it's a diversity we have trouble seeing now, but it was diverse because there were Irish, there were German, there were Polish, there were Jewish. That was seen as diversity back then. They were seen as not quite white, and in academia we call them probationary white. Is this something everybody knows? It was news to me when I was in grad school, but I don't know how much what we professors now take for granted everybody else knows. But yeah, the whiteness is a coalition. It's a group, and different people get allowed into that coalition of whiteness at different times. In the 19th century, what we now think of as ethnic Europeans were not fully permitted into that coalition. Enough, they were allowed to immigrate because the immigration laws allow free white persons, and so Europeans could come when Samoans couldn't. But not enough that they were allowed to have any job or live anywhere.
We saw this a lot with immigrant populations from Germany, Italy, places like that, where they would come in droves, but the jobs were labor-intensive jobs. They were construction jobs. They were not necessarily automatically led into the city in this kind of way that they do now.
And they're the ones who built Chicago. They brought with them this dream of home ownership, and they helped build Chicago. And they, at the moment of the fire, they had homes mostly on the north side. The part that burnt the most was Irish and German. And they were blamed for the fire, you know, the whole myth of This is O'Leary's cow, you know, which is a myth, by the way. But it was a way of blaming the Irish female person who was milking at the wrong time of day, because you shouldn't even need to have a lamp when you're milking your cow. They were blamed for being not quite proper people. And one of the ways they wanted to use homeownership was to assert their respectability and their domesticity. Yeah. They're not foreigners. And they would compete, you know, like the Slovaks claim they owned more homes than the Czechs because they thought it made them look better. You know, the ethnic press of Chicago is really, really fascinating.
Well, I mean, I also think that obviously the roots in this being a melting pot, the idea of the city of neighborhoods, and you see that in what we're talking about. When the fire happened, one of the things I thought was interesting in the book was sociologically as well, the fact that everybody was stranded.
Yes. So at the moment of the fire, it's great for urban historians because everybody was talking about the structure of the city. And part of the panic of the fire was that without the built environment, you couldn't tell who was rich and who was poor. And there was this intermingling of classes, of genders, and it seemed dangerous to people. Immediately after the fire, the aldermen built barracks to house the homeless, which makes good sense. But then the elite philanthropists of the city took over administering the aid that had been donated to Chicago. And those native-born elites did not want the barracks. They found them very, very dangerous. And so they tore down the barracks. It was winter. The fire happened in October. It was a cold winter. You had more than 8,000 people who needed some place to live. And instead of letting them stay in the barracks, they tore down those barracks to erect single-family homes. And they felt that single-family homes were healthier physically because germs can't spread as well, but healthier morally too. They had this idea that if you can see who's going in the door, you know who's sleeping with whom. That they really felt that apartment living is this dangerous, promiscuous French thing, and that we don't want it in Chicago. Some of the workers' leaders were also saying, those elites, they want to get us in houses, they want to tie us to the land the way the peasants were, they want to have us paying mortgages so we can't go on strike, so we lose some of our freedom, that it was this sort of conspiracy. And there are ways you can see this after the fire, that the elites really wanted people into houses.
Right.
But the working class people, they wanted houses of their own. And so they accepted these houses, and they were tiny houses that the relief fund would help you build. They accepted these houses, but they wanted to build them close to where they worked. And so after the fire, it's much less known than the fire itself, but in January of 1872, the working class immigrants from the North Side stormed City Hall because they were mad at what we would now call zoning rules. But back then, they were new fire safe rules.
Right, the rules that you had to abide to build a house. And
yes.
A lot of the German and Irish were like, I want to build a house how I want to build a house. And they were pretty restrictive because they just went through a huge fire. Right.
The rules were classist, though. They were rules that prohibited building with wood. You had to build with brick, and brick is a lot more expensive than wood. But you could still build a fancy elite mansard roof that is actually incredibly flammable. So they weren't exactly rules to protect from fire. They were rules to protect from poorhouses. And the poorhouses that were seen as more dangerous fire hazards.
Interesting.
And so the rules were justified as we're protecting from fire, but the workers said, no, those rules are ridiculous. And if you make us build with brick, we can't actually build. And we, poor people, we didn't have the fire insurance that the rich people had. All we have is the fact that we have this little plot of land we owned. And if we can't build on it, we have to sell it for nothing. We have to move far outside of the city limits to build the cheap houses that are all we can build. They felt incredibly threatened, and they stormed City Hall in a way that was very threatening to City Hall people. They shut down City Hall. The English language press accused the immigrants of trashing the place. The immigrants said that all they did was march in to explain their point of view. But it was this amazing moment when housing that matters to me, a housing historian, also clearly mattered to the people on the ground.
The book is called The Working Man's Reward, Chicago's Early Suburbs and the Roots of American Sprawl. The author is Elaine Lewinnick. We'll take a quick break and we'll continue our conversation with Elaine here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking with Elaine Lewinnick. She is the author of The Working Man's Reward, Chicago's Early Suburbs and the Roots of American Sprawl. She's an associate professor of American Studies at California State University, Fullerton. She joins us here for the second half of the interview. You know, we talked before the break about suburban sprawl. Let me ask you, I mean, when did suburban sprawl start in the Chicago area?
Well, so we have to actually back up and try to define suburbs, because there are myths that suburbs are all the same, that they are the boring and the bland place with the desperate housewives and everybody's white. And the more you look at Chicago, anyone from Chicago could tell you that's not true for Chicago. The suburbs are diverse, and they're diverse in interesting ways. There's elite suburbs and there's working class suburbs. And even you take an elite suburb like Evanston, it wasn't built as residential retreat. It was built around the university. And it's not only white, it has a significant African American population. And every suburb you look at is different and mm-hmm. interesting. So Chicago has suburbs, and it has some of those domestic suburbs, the bedroom community suburbs, middle class suburbs, but it also has working class suburbs.
But I mean, I mean, major areas like New York or LA or other places like that, is it similar patterns? I mean, do you see suburban life the same way that you do in Chicago?
When you're talking about LA, you have to tell everybody. Yeah. Watts is a suburb. Compton is a suburb. It's got single-family home ownership. It's black home ownership and more Latino home ownership, but it's still suburban outside the central city. So each time you have to explain to people that the myth of suburb doesn't actually mm-hmm. work when you look on the ground at any particular space. And the fact that we have this myth that is contradicted by life on the ground is really interesting.
Where's the myth come from?
I think it comes from marketing. You know, that because suburbs are an idea and they're also an investment. So people buy their houses because they're hoping at some point to resell it. You're hoping to make a profit from it. And so you have to imagine that there's some neutral buyer out there who's going to want what you want. So this whole thing gets marketed. But I grew up in a suburb of Boston that is, it's a famous suburb too. Mine was not a single family home. After my parents divorced, my mom took in boarders, and so did half our neighbors. We didn't talk about it, though. I'm sorry, I'm not speaking so clearly, you know, we weren't supposed to tell our neighbors that we took in boarders because we didn't have all the proper permits for renting out the third floor to our tenants. And my sister, who is much more attuned to issues of prestige than I am, told me that it doesn't make us look good that we rent our third floor. So we're just not going to mention it. And I think, though, that experience of we just don't mention it, but we know the neighbors across the house, the way are... they have their adult kids
yeah,
still living with them.
Yeah, that's a shared experience, of
course. That, you know, that yeah. all sorts of people, and even if it is more prestigious, those people have their au pair living with them. It's not always a single family
in
one place.
For you as a historian, what was it about Chicago and the early suburbs of Chicago? I mean, you talk about it, and that's what I'm getting at with New York and L.A. Yeah. and the difference. What was it about this experience that you latched onto that said, this is the beginning of what we know as the suburbs in this country?
Chicago's so fascinating because it grew so quickly. It doubled in size almost every decade of the 19th century. And can you imagine living in a city that doubles in size and then 10 years later doubles again in size? So it's this city that was growing very self-consciously and promoting itself very self-consciously. And I didn't know till I researched this book that Chicago got called the Windy City not because of the wind off the lake,
of course, yeah.
but because of its boasting.
Right.
It's the bragging city. And I love that about Chicago, that it is this very documented city. Richard Wright, the great African-American writer, called it the known city. Mm-hmm. It's this city that was growing quickly and selling itself. It's famous for its boosters, and it's also famous for its social workers, its sociologists, all of these people who were watching Chicago. And there is such great turn-of-the-century literature about Chicago. And so to understand what a suburb looks like, you can look at Chicago and see it growing at the same time as the idea of suburbs. And you can see the marketing because Chicago has these incredible archives. So you can see those early ads. And then you can also see not just the marketing, but the social workers who were going door to door and documenting what was really happening in these places that were putatively suburbs.
I mean, a big part of your book is dedicated to the relationship, the race relations in this area, the race riots of 1919. You talk about the mortgages of whiteness. We know that in Chicago, it's been very well documented, this white flight, this concept of people leaving different areas for the suburbs because, you know, they wanted to live around white people. They want to be around African Americans in Chicago. That's the story that's been told, redlining, mm-hmm. everything in between. But let's go back because
yeah.
that's the one thing Jonathan Rose talked about as well, was this idea of the mortgages and the concepts of almost the mortgage industry creating suburbs because they offered mortgages to certain people to say, this is a good mortgage for you. Come on out.
So suburbs come earlier. You know, the mortgage industry is actually after the 1930s and after the 1950s. And I'm interested in the earlier roots of it. And the earlier suburbs of Chicago, it's not white flight. These people didn't identify as white. They were identifying as Polish or German or Irish or all sorts of other things. The early suburbs of Chicago came for a couple overlapping reasons. And one of them was factories. Because for most factories, you need horizontal space. There are some businesses like journalism where you're still in downtown Chicago. We're talking right now from downtown Chicago. You can do it in vertical space in these skyscrapers. But if you're doing something like meatpacking, which helped invent the assembly line in America, you need horizontal space. And that is expensive if you're in the central city. So things like meatpacking moved out of the city quite early, partly because they were inventing the assembly line and partly, too, because they wanted to avoid city rules about disposing of all the gross byproducts. So they moved out early to a place outside the city that was called then the Town of Lake. It even had a name in Lithuanian. It was Town Lakis. I don't actually speak Lithuanian, so I might be bungling that. But I love that it was called Town Lakis. And then Chicago, because it was trying very, very hard to boost itself, Chicago annexed a lot of its outlying areas because they really wanted to win the census of 1890. They wanted to be the fastest growing city. And so they took in all sorts of things that weren't really considered city at the time. So Lake was absorbed into Chicago, along with the Andersonville on the north side and all sorts of things. But
we know as neighborhoods now were considered like early suburbs. But they were, go ahead.
Yeah, and they still have their own names. You know, although Town of Lake has lost its name, we now think of it as Back of the Yards. This is what drew me into the project, is the ad that you see on the cover, is this ad repeated in so many suburban histories that's by this Chicago developer named Samuel Eberle Gross, who I adore, partly because he named places after himself. He really thought Grossdale and Grossville and Gross Ave were great names. They've all changed their names now. But he built all sorts of interesting suburbs, and he had some great marketing. So this one ad of his is called The Working Man's Reward, and it shows an angel descending in a burst of light to a working man who's sitting in a desolate landscape. And the angel is presenting him with this suburban pastoral house. And this ad is used in a lot of suburban histories to explain this is why America suburbanized. It's these Christian ideas of morality that come with the home. It's this pastoral ideal. And the ad on the top says only $100 down, easy terms. You know, it's also these financing terms that Chicago developed early on in the 1830s. They called it canal terms because nobody had any cash, but they all wanted to buy land before the canal was built and the land went up in value. So this ad is used all the time. But when you actually look at the ad, one of my advisors in grad school told me you always have to look at the addresses and look at the maps. And the address is 47th and Ashland Ave. That's the stockyards. And it's 1890s stockyards. That means blood was running down the street. It means there were so many flies, you could not tell what color those houses were painted because they were covered in flies.
Wow.
It is not the place I picture when I think of suburbs. And yet, it's in this classic suburban ad. And so I went back to find Samuel Eberle Gross's marketing book that this ad comes from. And all you have to do is flip the page. And the very next page explains, buy a house in my subdivision and you can go home for lunch. It's not the same commuter suburb we think of. It's live next to your work in the stockyards. And that you, as a working man in the stockyards, must really, really want to own your own home because you want to have something you can control. And that another one of Samuel Eberle Gross's ad lines was, better than a bank for a poor man.
Mm-hmm.
And before 1930s banking laws, banks failed all the time. So workers in Chicago, they were struggling. They didn't have a lot of extra money. But when they did have extra money, putting it in a bank was a really risky thing to do. Putting it into real estate was safer because it was an investment you could see and touch, and then you can improve it yourself because you're a working class person. You know how to build a veranda or have a garden. You come from a rural background, and so you can use this space to help you navigate big corporate industrial capitalism. You don't have much control over work anymore when you're working in the factories. But here you can control your home, which is a sort of work too.
Yeah.
It's different from the elite version of suburbs, which is home is a break from work.
Right.
But not that different because even elites want to gain some value from their property. But instead, it's much more conscious of this is a business too. And you can have a garden, you can take in boarders, you can, in one of Samuel Eberle Gross's ads, he explains, you can open a laundry because your things will dry better out here in the outskirts of town. And then you can make a lot of money in case you lose your job or you need to balance other things in the whole family economy. So suburbs, instead of being this post-war desperate domestic thing or this conspiracy to control the working class, it turns out workers chose suburbs themselves.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
So they wanted this, but it also turns out you can't fully control your property values. You know, you buy a house in Town of Lake and it might be good for a while, but even as early as 1910s, by the 1920s, the stockyards are slowing down. Meatpacking is moving to Kansas. It's moving further away. And then you're stuck. You have this investment that you thought you could control because you thought you could fix up the attic and make it into a better house. You thought you had this control, but you don't really. Yeah. Because there's these bigger forces. There is the huge banking forces, and working class people had trouble getting access to credit then as now. There is these huge economic forces. So if you bought in a factory suburb or an industrial suburb, if that factory closes down, you're much more stranded.
Well, I mean, we see that now. I mean, it's interesting to think about what was the Nabisco factory that closed down in the South Side not too long ago. We see it with auto factories where a lot of people set up shop close by and then that factory leaves and there's despair or we see at least stress on the property values of
yes.
the place. As we wrap up, like the lessons that are learned from your book, I mean, what goes around comes around.
Seems like so what happened in Chicago simple, yeah. is that when people were seeing this thing their family had struggled to own, the property values weren't working the way they wanted to. The easiest person to blame was the African Americans who were just moving in around World War I. It was the early part of the Great Migration. And so African Americans don't actually bear the blame for these property values that you can't control, but it's much easier to attack the blacks
than it is to blame a person,
banks right. or the factory or these great bigger structural forces. So in Chicago, there were two housing-related riots that frame my book. And the first is the one after the Great Chicago Fire when immigrants were fighting for the right to own homes within the city limits. Mm-hmm. And the other is the riots of 1919, which have confounded people who study them for a long time because they weren't riots over work. Blacks and whites were working together by 1919 in Chicago, but they were not living together. And they were riots over leisure space and home space. And people were attacked on the streetcars going home from work. And people were killing each other over property values and ideas of property values. And I call this the mortgages of whiteness because there's this whole idea that the working class in America gets divided by race because whites feel a psychological wage that for a long time we've called the wages of whiteness. That you might not be paid that much, but at least you can sit anywhere in the movie theater and at least you can right. go to any park. It's this the wages of whiteness. And I think related to that is the mortgages of whiteness, the feeling that you can get on this upwardly moving escalator of property values, that you can hope for this dream that wasn't an immigrant dream but became an American dream of home ownership. And the easiest one to blame when that dream turns to a nightmare, it was the African Americans. And so there was a riot in 1919. It shows how much suburbs aren't just this natural thing. They're not just a homogeneous simple thing. They're not just the way America happens. And some Chicagoans thought it was natural. They said, oh, it's a prairie city. Chicago mm-hmm. can extend mm-hmm. anywhere. Pretty soon we'll tunnel the lake and annex Canada. They really thought that would right. happen, you know? But they're right, though. Chicagoland does extend to Wisconsin and right. Indiana now in amazing ways. They said there's no impediments to growth here in Chicago. It's flat everywhere. The only problem is the Canadian border, which is hilarious. But also, people want to live close. People want to live in community. And people built schools and parishes and other things, and they didn't all want to move out. There was a lot of resistance to suburbanization, even as there was this hope of grasping onto the opportunity that suburbanization meant. So that's why Chicago is a fascinating story.
Author Elaine Luenick, her book, The Working Man's Reward, Chicago's Early Suburbs and the Roots of American Sprawl. She is a professor at American Studies at California State University, Fullerton, also a housing historian. Yeah. Elaine, thanks for coming
You're
in.
Welcome.
Thanks for telling us about the history
I
of early
to
suburbs.
I want to say to Chicagoans, they wrote the textbooks for early realtors, and they invented the real estate
All
lobby.
Right. You got to come back, just so we can talk about the real
Chicago's
estate lobby.
Chicago's amazing.
Yeah. Thanks for being here.
Okay, bye.
Good to have Elaine Lewenick on. She's come through again. We'll have her on. We'll continue to talk about it. It's interesting about the marketing and how the real estate industry as we know it sort of started here in Chicago. Coming up, we'll talk with Ashley Brown. She is the Broadway star. She was Mary Poppins. She's going to be performing at Orchestra Hall right here, the Symphony Center down here on Michigan Avenue. Members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. The show starts on Friday and it runs till next Friday. It's called Mary Mary Chicago, sort of singing Christmas standards. So we're going to talk with her about her career, about singing Christmas music, but also about her career. We're helping you get in the holiday spirit with our presentation of A Christmas Carol this Friday, December 16th from 10 to noon. Are you ready? I love this time of year. Last year we did Miracle on Jerry Wells Street. This year, is it just called A Christmas Carol? Right? It's just A Christmas Carol. We're not putting someone's name in it that we work with. Huh. We're losing it here. DeCastro leaves and we're no longer putting names in shows. It's got to be, right? Anyway, A Justin Kaufman Carol is coming up. This Friday, it's December 16th, 10 to noon. I'm excited. Listen or watch at WGNRadio.com or on the WGN Radio app. I'm playing Bob Cratchit in this performance. Hopefully I'll shake off because we're doing the show tomorrow night. We're only doing an hour tomorrow night from 10 to 11 after the Hawks game. Greg Flamm will be here. We'll do a holiday-themed swap meet. Very excited about that. But then I'll turn around, come back in here, get my Bob Cratchit on, and just play a Bob Cratchit opposite a Bill Left Scrooge. I'm looking forward to Left Kaufman. That's what they should call it. A Left Kaufman production. I mean, obviously Steve Cochran's got a big role in it. It's the Ghost of Christmas Past, I believe. That's the talkie ghost. Presents, Wendy's Ghost of Present, and Future doesn't talk. That's what I thought I was going to get. I thought I'd get the one that doesn't talk for the radio play, but I think it's just a bunch of sound effects. Sound effects got it. You can check out my audition. It's on WGNRadio.com. Check it out, where I show the auditioners the different accents I can do, my different skills. I can play bass, things like that. All right. The whole thing is sponsored by Lightkeeper Pro Tool Set, Lou Malnati, Station Chicago, and Spot Hero. And it's going to be Friday, 10 a.m. here on 720 WGN. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a Broadway star, and she's in town for performance at Orchestra Hall. Put your hands together for Ashley Brown. Ashley Brown has had a tremendous career at such a young age. She originated the role of Mary Poppins back in 2006 for the Broadway musical, which she received a slew of award nominations. She's done several other shows, including Beauty and the Beast. And here in Chicago, she did Showboat and Oklahoma at the Lyric back in 2012-2013. And she's also performed with all the big orchestras here in the country. She sang with the Boston Pops, the New York Philharmonic, and members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, where she's on stage at Orchestra Hall for the next week for a performance of Mary, Mary, Chicago. It starts Friday night and runs till next Friday night. And it's my pleasure to welcome Ashley Brown to the Download tonight. Ashley, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm interested in your, I mean, you do a lot with the American Standards, with Songbook. What's the difference with doing Christmas music? You're doing a whole Christmas thing here with members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. What is it that makes the music so special?
I think it's just the season. You know, everybody's excited. You know, it's Christmas, it's the holidays, and it's always fun to sing songs that everybody knows. But there's also a lot of pressure there, like the songbook. You know, everybody grew up with these songs. Everybody grew up with these Christmas tunes or holiday tunes. And so at the same time, there's a lot of pressure on it, too, because you want it to be what everybody knows and wants, but at the same time, you want to add your own magic right. and add your own flair to it. And so that was the struggle, and what I loved most about making the album is finding my own a place in these songs that everybody knows. Right. And then that's what I try to do with the Christmas songs as well.
I'm intrigued because we had a band in here earlier this week, and we talked about they were playing Christmas music in Studio 435, and they talked about how some of these songs are difficult when it mm-hmm. comes to like the chord structure and the way. So as a singer, I mean, we know Jingle Bells, and we may know some of these songs, and we go, oh, these are easy, they're singing. But for an actual, you know, professional singer, these are somewhat sophisticated, if not difficult songs.
Absolutely. The orchestrations are always just really intricate. And really, you know, they're written like hymns almost, you know, where everything is just so involved and you will never look up. Like some of the more pop standards now, you might look up and some instruments might not be playing. But with these Christmas songs, there's not one instrument that's not playing at all times.
They would do
it's so full.
The block, the wood block, right? There's a lot of
even
that.
Even the triangles
right?
going.
The triangles going. For you, I mean, you've sang before with orchestra.
Of course.
You know, we just talked about this. I mean, and obviously there's orchestral music in Broadway shows, but talk about the idea of getting up and performing alongside an orchestra without the Broadway play, just the idea of singing standards and singing with orchestras.
You know, it's absolutely completely different. People think it's kind of along the same lines. And the difference is in a Broadway show, the orchestra is in a pit, and there would be years you could be doing a Broadway show and you don't know who your drummer is because you never see the pit.
Right.
They're below you. They're literally underneath you in an orchestra pit. And what I love about doing orchestra work is I'm on stage with the symphony. I'm making music with them. They
right.
aren't just supporting me.
You're another instrument.
Yeah, it's a
right.
conversation between me and the orchestra at all times, and we're making music together. There's sometimes when it's their moment to shine. There's some moments when it's my moment to shine. And versus a Broadway show where they literally are accompaniment. And that's what I really loved. And, you know, from playing Belle and Beauty and the Beast and Mary Poppins, you know, those are such iconic roles. And I'm always in so much wigs and makeup and lights and costume and layers of wool and flying over the audience and doing all these crazy things, which was amazing.
You're not flying over the audience at Orchestra Hall for this?
Oh, might have to wait and see. Get your tickets. But it was nice to go out and just be Ashley. And I think that's what attracted me to it at first, about 5 years ago when I started doing this. And it's really developed for me because I got to see who Ashley was as a performer, not Ashley being Mary or Ashley being Belle
right,
or Ashley
right.
being Lori or Magnolia in the different shows I've done. And so that was really an interesting part for me as an entertainer.
Is it challenging having the relationship change? I mean, you being the star and having the orchestra accompany you mm-hmm. As opposed to being another instrument as, you know, for the conductor to create the music. Was that a challenge for someone who is trained for onstage work?
At first it was because, you know, I was always trained to look at a script and look at the characters. And I don't have that when I go on as Ashley. And so it was in a way very freeing, but in a way scary, you know, because I've always been who I am. I'm from the South. I'm from Pensacola, Florida. And so I've always been kind of what you see is what you get kind of girl. And so I've really started enjoying that. But at first, it made me kind of cocoon myself. I was very nervous. And then as I got comfortable, I'm like, I'm liking this. I can talk when I want, say what I want, walk how I want. And in a way, it was really freeing. But at the same time, I love going back to musicals and kind of, you know, finding myself in other characters as well.
We're talking with Ashley Brown. She is a Broadway star. She was Mary Poppins in Mary Poppins back in 2006. She's done a number of shows. She is actually in town for a show with members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at Orchestra Hall right here on Michigan Avenue. A show called Merry Merry Chicago. It starts Friday and it goes for a week.
Mm-hmm.
Where did your lifelong love of music come from? I mean, I read somewhere that you were trained early in your life and you got into music when you were a young kid.
Mm-hmm.
But where does it come from?
You know, it's a funny thing because I'm the youngest of four kids and nobody in my family sings, dances. My mom kind of played the piano a little bit, but so we don't know where I came from. I started singing in church, but like any five-year-old, I was in the church choir, but I kind of started always getting the solos, and one of my mom's favorite stories is she was sitting in church, and it was Christmas Eve, which is why Christmas music is even more special to me. And the woman next to her goes, well, I didn't know Ashley could sing. And my mom goes, well, I didn't either. And she goes, and the rest was history. Because she was like, it took somebody else going like, she's not just like a screeching six-year-old. Like she's got, like, maybe I was nine at the time, at that time. And so we just kind of went from there. My parents were both flying blind with this musical child. And I just was very lucky to come across the right people at the right time. And that's just where music, it's where I thrived. I was never good at sports. I was always the last one picked. I was very good in school, but I wasn't like, oh, science, oh, history. I was a good student. Right. I made great grades. But I remember when I found music, and I remember just it making me come alive and get out of my shell, and something I really thrived in.
I'm always interested in it because we have a lot of professionals who will come on and talk about when they were a young kid, they got into the arts. But there really is two phases to it. There's having a passion for it and having skill, but then there's also being able to translate that to a professional experience. For you,
absolutely,
talk about the training, because a lot of people will say, I'm a great musician, and you get to music school or some sort, and you're not necessarily, the next step is not to be on Broadway. You may either go in a different direction. But talk about, you know, when you got to the stage of professionally training, what propelled you to stay in the business, stay in the industry, and how it all got you to Broadway?
You know, I think the root of that, it was my parents, because I feel they always let me do it because I loved it. And I never was made to go. But I remember when I started voice lessons when I was a freshman in high school. And there was times I missed homecoming because I had a voice competition. But my mom always let me choose. Like, do you want to do this or do you want to do that? But as soon as you commit, we're doing whatever we're doing. And I think that was instilled in me at a very young age. But I just chose it because I loved it. And I was able to see past homecoming and see past high school. Like, I wanted to do this forever. And I was excited that looking back, I'm like, well, who did I think I was? You know, but I think being so naive helped me.
I mean, I think that's interesting because there are choices you have to make in your life. And I'm sure you look back and say, I kind of wish I could have gone to homecoming.
Yeah. But in that moment when you're 16, homecoming is everything.
Right.
But now looking back, I'm like, thank God I didn't go there because, I mean, it got me into a good college and I'm on Broadway and all those kind of things. But, you know, I always just did it because I loved it, and I chose it because it made me happy. And it was something that I wanted to do, and I knew that God gave me a gift and I wanted to use it to better the world and just myself.
I mentioned, you know, Mary Poppins, which was your really breakout star show, Mary Poppins on Broadway, 2006. That would have, I was doing a little math, you know, I could do some math. You're 24 years old? Yeah, exactly. 24 years old to go into that role, to be the star in Mary Poppins. Talk about that. Talk about, I mean, being such at a young age, being a star on Broadway, I mean, that had to have been extremely anxiety-ridden.
It was.
I can't even imagine what I was doing at 24.
Well, it was. I was like, I don't even know how to grocery shop for myself yet. And here I am running a Broadway show with my face on the front of the theater. But the good thing is I played Belle in Beauty and the Beast on Broadway first. That was my Broadway debut. And I was the 15th Belle. You know, good solid number. One of a kind I am. And I remember going, life could not get any better. You know, I'm like, how did I end up here? I mean, I graduated college a year before, and I moved to New York with my one-way ticket, just started auditioning, and I did it. You know, I pounded the pavement. I worked really hard
in college.
That's
an American success story, right?
It is, and I just feel so grateful because I was like, I'm going to work at Banana Republic. You know, I'm going to wait tables until my big moment comes, and then it was like, boom. And I remember calling my mom being like, Mom, I'm going to be on Broadway. And they were like, what? Like, we were so excited, but it was the most bizarre, like, we couldn't quite handle it. And when I heard my agents called and said that Mary Poppins is coming to Broadway and they want to see you, but of course it was with everybody and their mother was going in. And I was on, I had Disney on my side, but Cameron McIntosh also was producing Mary Poppins and he didn't know me. And so I really had to go in, and after 9 auditions over a period of 4 months, I basically did everything but fly on my own. Tom Schumacher, who's head of Disney Theatricals, came in my dressing room at Beauty and the Beast and was like, you know, I'm here, right? And I said, I don't know. He's like, we want you to be our Mary Poppins.
What?
And I was like, what? I remember getting my wig on for Beauty and the Beast, being like, wait, I'm her? Because I knew who I was up against, and I had the least amount of experience. I mean, I was so green.
Any situation where there's going to be there's a Broadway musical, and then there's Mary Poppins. I mean, there's going to be a lot of competition for that role.
Exactly. And it was that a moment of elation to, oh, no, I have to do it. You know, it was like, this is now in my hands. And Tom Schumacher at that point goes, your life will never be the same. And boy, was he right.
I mean, obviously there's a lot of stress and challenges in any role in Broadway, and playing Belle is a huge deal of Beauty and the Beast. But it was something that they had already had the sort of mechanism
exactly.
set up. You were the 15th Belle.
I was the 15th. I just slid this right in there
brand,
and did it.
This was a brand new concept. This is a brand. So,
absolutely.
I mean, for you to do that, to be a successful, not just do Mary Poppins, but be successful and also tour with it. I mean, it's a big part. I mean, what did you know about Mary Poppins' story before you even got involved in that?
Well, I grew up with the movie, as we all did, and I remember having dances to every song that I'd make my family watch, which was very telling. But being a girl from the South, I never in a million years thought I would grow up to be Mary Poppins. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of irony in there. And I just, it was one of those moments where I just, it was, I was at the right place at the right time, and you know, it was where opportunity met preparation. That's what I always say. I don't like to say luck, because I think a lot of work goes into right. being prepared for that moment. And at the same time, I don't know if I was the most prepared, but they definitely saw something in me, because they didn't want Julie Andrews playing Mary Poppins. So I went in as Ashley, just did. I mean, of course, I'm sure I butchered the accent. They hired me a coach once I got the part. And I just did how I see her. And I never read the books growing up. So that when I was auditioning, I heard, you know, that the story, the musical was based
would
a lot
be more
on the
in
books.
The books, right.
So I really dove into those, and it was found a lot of that character that, you know, just, you know how books always have more.
Do you do that
detail.
as an actress on Broadway? I mean, when you get an opportunity to audition for stuff, I mean, are you the kind of person who does as much research as possible
absolutely.
Before the audition?
You can't be too prepared. Especially for all the unknowns. And that's how I like to go into an audition. I'm almost overly prepared to a point of ridiculousness, because I know myself and I don't do well lifting material, which means like looking at the page and saying the line, looking
right.
at the page. Like I'll lose my place, get distracted. And then if the director wants to see something different, I know it and I can be like, okay, let me add that extra layer. And so that's, I've always as much information as I can get, I get. But playing that part, I have to say, was a huge shoes to fill. And every time I really thought about it, it became too big for me. And I'd have to look myself in the mirror and be like, girl, you got to get it together. So I would just be like, oh, I'm just, you know, because when you're in a theater, it could be anywhere. I'd be like, oh, I'm just like in Little Pensacola doing Mary Poppins. You know, if I think like, oh, I'm on 42nd Street at the most infamous theater at the New Amsterdam Theater, originating the role of Mary Poppins on Broadway, you know, it just would have been too much. And I look back and I'm like, gosh, I was so naive. And I look back, I'm like, I wonder if I could do that now,
well,
like going into those.
You know, we've asked other, I always think Broadway is a great, I mean, to get to the top, to be originating a Mary Poppins Broadway musical is so impressive. And we've had Broadway stars on the show before, but then, you know, it's a 2-year run, maybe mm-hmm. maybe a year and a half, and you sort of have to look for the next gig.
Yeah.
I mean, as you are now, you're performing music at orchestras, and you're here in town with the members of the symphony. Talk about what's next for you. I mean, it's a tough business in the fact that you were, you know, you are a Broadway star, but you still have to go in and audition and compete.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
To get every single. Do you see yourself staying on Broadway? Do you see yourself attempting to get with Broadway musicals moving forward?
Absolutely. You know, I did. When you're in a Broadway show, it's 8 shows a week, and yeah. I was doing 8 shows a week nonstop with Beauty and the Beast and Mary Poppins. It was almost about 5.5 years nonstop, and when I left Mary Poppins, I kind of took a break and started doing the orchestra work, because I love what I do so much, but I was getting really burnt out.
Right.
I was exhausted.
I mean, 8 shows a week, 2 shows
and
3.
And then just have Monday nights off. That's the only day off. And I just kind of got to a point where I'm like, I love what I do too much to get too tired. And what was happening was, which happens to all performers, all Broadway performers, you just got to have to like take a moment, you know? And that's what I did. And I just had a baby, and, you know, and it's, my priorities have shifted, not necessarily just for right now. And, you know, when I do the symphonic work, you know, she's been to London with me. I just was with the BBC Orchestra at Royal Albert Hall.
She's here tonight.
She's here tonight, and we're not hearing her, which is just delightful. Mother of the year. And, you know, she's just my main priority right now. She's only 7 months right now.
Oh.
So we're just kind of finding our way. But I absolutely want to do another Broadway show, but it just has to be that right one
right.
to make me not put my baby to bed every night.
Ashley Brown is in town. She is starring in Mary, Mary, Chicago, which is a show, a performance at the Orchestra Hall with members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. It starts on Friday. It goes for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And you're playing standards, Christmas standards. There's
yes.
a whole thing. There's the children's choir. And a lot a lot of things going on.
Yes.
This is a big show for the folks at Orchestra Hall. Ashley, thanks so much for coming in, and good luck with the show and good luck with your career.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, you can go to WGNradio.com right now and check out the page for school closings. A lot of schools in the Chicago area closing tomorrow. Not Chicago Public Schools, but most of the schools. And again, I mean, it's early, so there might be some changes. But if you look on WGNradio.com, you see schools like Bailey Elementary in Chesterton, Balmoral in Crete, Barack H. Obama Learning Academy, Markham, they're closed. Brady School in Aurora. So I don't know. You know, it's so interesting. There's a long list of closings for tomorrow. But you can't. I don't know enough about, like, Hobart, Indiana is the high school is closed, but they're opening late. So either it's closed or opening late. Always, yeah. Yeah, get to sleep in? You get to sleep in, but it'll still be late. All because of this cold. The other big story, of course, the Chicago Bears, Green Bay Packers on Sunday. There's going to be another cold front coming through. You heard Skilling today saying that this could be the coldest game in modern football history. I was looking at an article today that said that the Ice Bowl, the famed Ice Bowl, the Packers and the Cowboys, was something like negative 40 wind chill. Maybe it was like negative 2 actual. And this is similar, if not worse. Like, it might be negative anywhere between 0 and it's still a couple days out, but anywhere from 0 to negative 5 and more on the wind chill. They were saying that tickets for this meaningless game at Soldier Field are going for $35 and around $35 on StubHub. Pete, would you go?
No.
If they gave you tickets, if tomorrow your friends said, listen, man, I got great tickets. They're up at the 50-yard line. They're awesome. You can have them for free. It's going to be too cold. Would you take them? Packers, Bears?
No. I would barely go if it in October. I like watching football at home.
Yeah, especially on days like that. But I will say, I don't know. I'm intrigued.
Really?
Yeah, if someone if a download faithful text in right now and said, I got 2 tickets, man. I wasn't going to go, but you want to try and do it? Let's go shirtless. Let's do it. Let's see what happens. I might be in. I went to a game. I remember for my wedding. This would have been 2004. I had given as a present to my best man and groomsman, my brother and Tommy. I gave him tickets. We're going to go to the Bears game. So I picked a day. I think it was in December. Towards the end of the year, but it was the year that Chad Hutchinson was the surfer.
Yeah,
was
I remember
take
him
to
well.
The Promised Land.
Unfortunately,
I think it was the first year of Lovie Smith, and Bears were like kind of like 5-7. They're playing the Texans at Soldier Field. Well, as we got closer to the weekend, it was a forecast like this. It was something. It was early December, being like, "Yeek! It's going to be 0. It's going to be 4 degrees at Soldier Field. Yikes!" And the Bears, you know, will the surfer be able to do it? And I bought these tickets. I bought them in advance. So I didn't get the option like everyone's getting now where you're like, well, you can get it for $10.
Yeah.
So they were still expensive, so we're going to go. So I got all the hand warmers. I dressed appropriately. We were at the South Loop Club early to drink our coffee and other stuff to get ready. And we went to the game, and it was cold. It was no doubt cold. I think we might have left early, mostly because to unbundle to pee was too much.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So... the only thing I remember is that we got a beer and the beer froze, like the top of it froze. But there was a guy like maybe like 5 or 6 rows up and over. I think we're sitting in the end zone who did the take the shirt off, right, for the cameras. And I don't think the cameras got him. And I've never really seen the effect on that except for it being cold. But, you know, the guy was doing it for a while standing up and he was drunk. And the swaying in the cold, like you could tell the cold had an effect on his body, and he almost wasn't even in control of it. Like he was just kind of swaying. So you're like, wow, that guy's drunk and has hypothermia.
Like, it was very strange. I'd never seen anything like that.
I feel like the people at Soldier Field should be under some obligation to say, you got to put a shirt on. Because we can't have somebody dying.
I think they watch closely. The best part of that story is that I did go to the bathroom and he was in there, right, without his shirt on, and he was on a cell phone. He was so drunk, he's belligerent, right? And he was peeing and he's on the phone talking. You know, it's really quiet in the bathroom, especially like when it's like at a Soldier Field. It's just like turn style.
Yeah.
And he goes. Oh, yeah, it's so fun, man. This is so great. I'm peeing right now next to a guy who looks just like Dicka, man. He's, like, old, and he looks like Dicka. And this guy with the mustache just kind of looks over. You know, he's at the urinal. He just kind of looks over, and I'm like, I'm going to kick your, you know, like, and nothing happened. Like, I got out of there before. But I just like the fact, like, say what you see. And it was super. So that guy, I mean, the idea of taking your shirt off was ridiculous, but I would do it. I don't know. My buddy Adam is coming back into town from California. Like he's flying in tomorrow. I don't know. If the tickets were free and it's Bears Packers and it's an event.
Really?
Why not?
I mean, I guess you could say that you had gone to the coldest game in NFL history. I mean, that's something to, brag on.
Get some long underwear on.
What do you put on your face? You get a face mask?
Yeah, you put like, maybe you do like one of the things like the robbers put on, you know? you know, and then you put a scarf over that. You got the big jacket. And then the truth of the matter is,
it's called a balaclava. Balaclava.
Balaclava. Really? But, you know, the key there is that if it is indeed too cold, I mean, the key is you don't pay. You're not paying for a ticket. Someone is punked out and doesn't want to go, and they're like, you can have the tickets, I don't want anything in return, I'm just not going to go, it's too cold. But to go there and experience it in the cold, and if it's too cold, you go walk around Soldier Field. Like, they made, it's all a mall in there now. Like, you can walk inside the actual, the columns and look at old, you know, old, I don't know.
Are there bars in there?
Jerseys.
Where you can, like,
I think so, yeah.
Actually sit and, you
I'm
know.
Not sure if you could sit. I haven't been to Soldier Field in a couple of years, but I feel like there are, but it's not like, you know, an indoor building. I mean, it still is cold. The issue will be how you get out of there because, you know, anyone who knows of a Bears game, essentially you hear the Bucket Boys as your soundtrack as you just aimlessly walk through Grant Park till you get somewhere close to Michigan Avenue, right? You know, like there's no – you can't call an Uber and be like, oh, can you pick me up at the Field Museum?
Right.
You know, so you just kind of walk through the underneath there and you just – you know it, right? That's the part that'll get you.
Trying to get out of there. Yeah, I don't know. The whole thing sounds miserable. I don't. If somebody would have to pay me $1,000. And even
well, it is.
Then,
I mean,
I don't even know
by
if
current,
I would do it.
I mean, it's worth the tickets could be a Packers Bears ticket could be worth that. So what if they just gave you a really good Packers Bears ticket?
No, I mean.
773 says, Justin, I went to both playoff games in 85. Froze my butt off, but I enjoyed it. That's a different story.
Yeah,
when you're playing the Rams and the snow's coming down, that's amazing experience. We're not talking about that here in December when it's very cold and we're playing a meaningless game where
right. The
third string is throwing to a rejuvenated Alshon Jeffrey who's now, I've learned from my ways, you know? Shut up.
Yeah, if this was Bears-Packers and they were fighting for the division,
it'd be a different story.
Yeah.
773 says, stay warm by...
Oh, no.
Rubbing Vaseline all over your body.
Yeah.
I would say maybe like exposed skin. I don't know about the whole body. That might just be your thing. Is there 847's got a great question. This might be one for Skilling, maybe for Martyr. Is there a temperature that they would cancel the game? Probably not. Right? I mean, that would have to be danger to humans, like, if you're out there and I guess they could argue that it's dangerous to humans.
Yeah.
But would they cancel a game if it was 105 degrees at Soldier Field?
No, I think they only do it if lightning is in the area.
Now, if there was lightning and it was -5, yeah, maybe. All right, we'll take a break. Again, I'm serious. If anyone wants to go, I'll go. Just my buddy Adam as well.
has to come with us as well.
Duke says Green Bay and Chicago. Hell yeah. He would go.
Yeah.
There you go. I had a good day today, and we went to the Lakeview Pantry, Violetta and I, for volunteer week here at WGN. Yeah. The Lakeview Pantry, which is the food pantry at 3945 Sheridan, right underneath the Sheridan L, the red line. They got a great space. It's brand new. It's only 6 months old, and we put together a video of volunteering, and Violetta said it'll probably be ready by Friday, maybe Thursday or Friday. It was a great time. Met a lot of great people there.
Great.
Learned about how they do their distribution and essentially how pantries work for making sure that people in Chicago have food. You know, there's an eligibility for people who are under a certain monetary level that they can get this food. And it's really well run, and the organization was really, really nice, and I got to help unload a van.
Oh, really? Yeah. So you were doing work. You were just just recording a video.
To be honest with you, Violetta was less communicative than probably I needed. She said, "Do you want to go to Lakeview Pantry? And I'm going to shoot video of volunteering." And I was like, "Oh, I thought I was going to volunteer. Like I thought it was like a shift." And I was like, "All right, yeah, I can do that." So like I got sort of motivated to do that, and I got there, and it was a video shoot. It was like I was doing the interviews. I was doing this. I was interviewing people, and I was like sort of talking to volunteers on camera.
Oh,
for this piece, and then it was done. They're like, "All right, well, we're done." I'm like, "Really?"
No,
so like I asked, I'm like, I still have like, I had a half hour till I had to go, and I was like, I can help, you know. So it's funny because it got.
Do we really work? Get some video of this.
No, but it was funny. It's like, yeah, make sure you get this. I was like, I could feel it because he's like, I think it's Greg was like, yeah, no, yeah, oh, you want to help out? Sure, move that box from there to there. And I'm like, that's a 30-second job. Right? Not even 15 seconds because I'm pretty strong. If you don't know nothing about me, I can lift two boxes at once. So I took the tangerines up front. And I'm like, all right, I'm ready. I'm ready for number two. Put me in the back. I can break down boxes, you know? I grew up in a grocery store. I worked at the Omni up on Route 31. I didn't grow up, but that's where, you know, I worked in high school.
Really?
Yeah.
Bagger and stuff?
I was a cashier. I started as a merchandise guy, like a guy in the back, a box or a bag, not
like a stock person
stock,
or something.
Yeah, I forgot what to call it. And then I realized that you could get $2 more an hour if you just took the math test and became a cashier. And there was a lot of stigma because this would be like the sort of early 90s. So there were like no guys who would be cashiers. And I'm like, it's $2 more and I don't have to break down boxes all violently.
Oh, yeah.
And so I did that. And I met all the ladies. I was a crowd pleaser. But this is what they would do. Like, I was taught, like, break that box down. You'd be violent with it. We'd rip it apart and break it down. Like, there was just, like, a cult of, like, you know, 10, 16-year-old boys in the back room, ripping boxes to put in. And I was taught that way. So I'm like, I can do the box if you want me to break the boxes down, but it's going to be a scene because I'm going to break it down like, you know.
Like the old,
taught.
Yeah.
I was taught. So they didn't give me that. Instead, they said, you know what we need you to do is if you can spray down the counters and get them ready, like take the Fantastic and spray it down.
And so just wipe them off?
Yeah, just wipe them off. Then I left.
Yeah, that's too bad.
It was a great time, though. And the video's great, and I can't wait for it to come out because it was fun to look at all the footage today. And Violetto's going to have it up on WGNRadio.com coming up in the next couple days. So Lakeview Pantry, check it out. It's, you know, the one thing I will say
is... So anybody can volunteer there?
Yeah.
Just go there?
Yeah, and I'm a person, you know, especially with my 9-year-old son. Like, I want more volunteer opportunities. I want to give back. I want to do some things, not necessarily just because I need to do it, but I want to teach him that.
I want to show him that.
I want to show that, you know, hard work to give back to a community. This is a good opportunity. I don't think they'll take a 9-year-old, but they have a whole thing. If you go to lakeviewpantry.org,
And there's like an orientation. You go at night, and it's like a one-hour kind of thing where they just teach you what you have to do, and then you sign up for shifts. It's 3 or 4 hours at a time. It's super community, meaning there's camaraderie. The people know each other, and even the new people are welcomed in. I always find that there's a little bit, and I think that's what Violetta's going for with her series, is just there's a little bit of barrier to volunteering because you don't know what you're getting. You're just confused about where I'm supposed to go and what you're supposed
to
do.
Right, yeah.
And they really sort of they
guide you in.
They guide you in. Like they're like, because it's
appreciative,
pretty much,
and
it's pretty much volunteer based there. So they have volunteers coordinators. Drew was the guy who was the volunteer manager. And that's what they're doing. And they sort of like set it out. So if you're looking for a volunteer opportunity on your hours or how you want to do it, and they have it all set up there. They're counting on volunteers. LakeviewPantry.org.
Yeah. Again, I'm gonna sign up for the box duty.
Right, exactly.
Show me how to do it.
What if I did that? If I just went in there and just like quickly like just took my shirt off, so I was just like down to my half shirt, you know, my.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, it's a lot of. I mean, it's aggression. You're just punching through and then ripping and then incinerating.
I can't believe that no other guys would take. I don't know. I can't believe that you were the first one to realize that you make $2 an hour doing.
Because you were ostracized and you were kind of you were judged. It was very, I don't know if this homophobic is probably not just, it was just sexist. They're like, why would you want to be on the cashier, dude? Be back with us. We get paid $4.75 an hour, bro. I'm like, I'll take the $7.75 an hour, and I'll get to hang out with all the smocked ladies in the front, right?
At Foot Locker, it was the dream to get out on the floor. You know, you go through that door from the stock room to the floor, right. And it's like,
I'll take two Air Jordans and let me get one of those Georgetown Hoya parkas. Can you get the old stick
hook,
to get it?
Yeah.
And I'll agree with Pete, since both Pete and I have worked shoes in our past. There's nothing worse than being stuck in the stockroom and having to put away what we used to call drags, which were the shoes that weren't purchased.
Oof.
And they would just stack up, Pete, man.
Oh,
those things
would
just, especially around the holidays.
Yeah,
and all the salespeople would just throw them back there at you.
Yep.
Now, see, the stock guys at the grocery store, they get, not only do they get the, have to break down the boxes, but all the boxes smell like rotten cantaloupes. So I don't know why, it's just the smell of a box. And so you'd have rotten cantaloupe all over you as well. So if guys want to go toe-to-toe, shoes versus bad produce, we'll do it all day. We'll do it all day. That's going to do it tonight for the download. We'll be back tomorrow night after the Hawks game. We just got 1 hour, 10 to 11. It'll be Friday, and that'll close out 2016. Jen Bosworth's in for Patty Vasquez tonight. Good to see you.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Okay, good. It's good I know how to work the mic since I've taken over. Hi.
How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. So what's on the show tonight?
I am in a play, and I have my castmates and the writer at the new colony called Punk about maximum security prison. I'm doing that. And then we're switching to holiday stuff, office party horror stories.
Oh, man.
And I have several because I worked for Nicolas Cage. I don't know if you know that, for 6 years as an assistant.
You know, I did not.
Okay. So anyway, that's
okay.
For another time.
Well,
but the point is.
That's for all night tonight.
Yes,
you better be telling all these stories.
I will. I had some very interesting holiday times.
Wow.
I was a drinker then, and
Nick Cage's crew. Right?
And so we're talking about that, and we'll talk about things to do in Chicago. We're going to talk about things to do even though it's freezing, and it's going to get even colder this
weekend.
Would
you take, if someone offered you free Packers-Bears at Soldier Field on Sunday, would you take them?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's going to be like the coldest game in NFL history.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
That's kind of a history.
Right?
To make history.
Right?
Are you
going
to go?
Know what's I was saying if I had the tickets, I probably would.
I would go.
The problem is that you know what will happen. It'll be like, oh, we looked at the records. It's a third, Colton.
Right.
And you're like, oh, what?
Right.
This is not
record making. I went to the first
making.
Cubs night game, and it was rained out.
That's right.
So I missed everything.
I was at a Christmas party a little bit earlier, just a quick dip in before the show, and a guy was coming from a different Christmas party, and he said, I said, how was it? He's like, it was okay. It was a 2-drink maximum. And I go, what do you mean? They're like, our office has a 2-drink maximum. And I was like, oh, interesting.
They're trying to stop the shenanigans.
That's what I said. I go, oh, that's great. I mean, that's to stop people from getting loaded. He's like, no, they're just cheap.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's probably the money. Oh, but I wish it was for the, because stuff happens.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's what I first thought. Yeah, I was that's perfect.
A lot of things have happened at holiday office parties.
2-drink maximum, then you're out.
I like that.
Right?
I like that.
Yeah. See, I just solved
all
problems.
What about here on Friday? You going to the...
I am. But see, I got a show that night, so I don't get the daytime booze going on.
Well, I don't ever get that.
Yeah.
Poor decision.
Yeah.
To do it in the daylight. Just wait. No.
That's all right. I'll make up for you.
Mark, Jerry will get his bells.
Okay, thanks.